Thank you very much. Wonderful, Michael. And thank you, Laura, who is just outside to keep in, to make all the Austrians lost in town come here. And thank you, Matthew, for preparing so well this conference. Before I start to talk about the essayistic practices of recycling images, I would like to mention a book about essay film that I co-edited more than 20 years ago, a book in German, as a result of a conference and a program in the Viennese Stadtkino. Our conference was called Essay Filme, and it took place in 1991. And immediately after this conference, there was another huge program curated by Peter Czarkowski called Found Footage Film. And it was a program that had much more spectators at the time than we had with the essay films, but we were close friends. And the interesting thing at the time was that no film that we had programmed figured in the program of the other of the found footage films. The two avant-gardes, if I may use Peter Boland's terms, I will come back to his eminent text, were still separated at the time. And the book that we published that came out of our conference included the text by Hans Richter that Laura Rascaroli was talking about, a translation of the text of Alexandra Struck and André Bazin, who speaks of lateral montage, and texts by Alexander Kluge, by Harun Farocki, who contributed to the conference, but also by critics and film scholars, texts about film letters, texts about the essayistic form by Frieda Grafe, by Schaub, but also texts by Raymond Bellour and Thomas Tode, who later, 20 years later, co-edited this book about essay film that Igor was talking about. So in the introductory article of this book, I was not only referring to Astruc, Bazin and Bellour, not only to Adorno and Musil, but also to Gilles Deleuze, who did not explicitly write about the form of the essay, but gave some approaches by concepts such as the new analytic of the image, a new form of relinking and turning the images. Deleuze sets up the idea of films that provide an heautonomous image where sight and sound become independent and where the speech is reaching its own limit, which separates it from the visual, and quote, the visual reaches its own limits, which separates it from the sound, end of quote. I still think, I don't want to come back to my essay from the time, but I just would like to say that we should consider a specific pensive relationship between word and image as essential for the, by the way, impossible definition of essayistic forms of films and installation. And as you see, even if you don't speak German, we called our book, the undertitle, essayistic film, not essay film, but essayistic, because we thought that there is not such a genre as the essay film, but only an essayistic form. I will present now some ideas developed since many years in an ongoing work about the essayistic use of archival image, but also about avant-garde practices. The book that Michael just mentioned, and this work was just continuing in some text and an issue of the Canadian journal Cinema. That I edited on the topic of the archive and where I was dealing with installations and performances. But now I will try to talk about the two avant-gardes and the idea of film as meta-history. In 1998 at the Cannes Film Festival, Godard, Jean-Luc Godard, having completed his Histoire du cinéma, presented a special reprint of the French magazine Trafic. This not only featured a collage compiled by Jonathan Rosenbaum with his added comments of his interviews with Godard and that latest magnum opus from the filmmaker, but also an article of the American artist Hollis Frampton. Frampton's essay, For a Meta-History of Film, Commonplaces, Notes and Hypotheses, written in 71, has traditionally been seen as the manifesto of the experimental avant-garde or the structural film. How can this spiritual kinship, unexpectedly embraced by Godard, be explained? Frampton does not appear in Godard's histoire any more than Peter Kubelka, Ernie Gier, or Michael Snow, or Jonas Mekas. What lurks behind this suddenly close relationship between two different traditions of the avant-garde? To use Peter Wolin's terminology, is it a matter of bringing the introverted anthology of pure cinema concerned with his own essence, the first avant-garde, into contact with the extroverted ontology influenced by André Bazin of what has become known as the second avant-garde? Should the dissociation between these two avant-gardes, maintained over the years by both filmmakers and critics, of form by symbolically removed after the fact? In Frampton's attempt to take an aesthetics of forms and material and from it develop a conception of history, making it possible to think of cinema as an art, Godard seems to recognize the inspiration of his own histoire, starting in the early 70s, probably under the influence of the discovery of electronic image technologies. Godard also became interested in thinking about history in a filmic form. Like Frampton, he sought to develop from within camera a form equivalent to the theory of knowledge, on which would not concern the construction so much as the function of film history. On the whole, Frampton saw cinema as an epistemological model. He published his text on the meta-history of film first in the magazine Art Forum in order to present one of his fundamental ideas of the meta-historical function of avant-garde cinema to a readership comprised of art lovers. "I was born during the age of machines," said the filmmaker who was born in the mid of the 30s, in other words, at a time when, I quote him, "the physical principles by which machines worked were intuitively verifiable, end of quote. For Frampton, who in his last films came to grips with the electronic era and computer-generated abstractions, cinema is only these lines, "the last machine," and also, quote, "the last art to address intelligence through the senses." And according to Frampton, the end of this age of machines did not come about with the emergence of video technology. It had already arrived in the early 40s with the invention of radar, enabling the observation of airspace by mechanical means via an anonymous black box. Frampton associates this quantum leap into the techniques of control with the birth of American avant-garde cinema as an independent movement represented by the films of Willard Maas or Maya Deren. At the same moment when Frampton was working on grounding American avant-garde cinema in the history of technique by defining the art of cinema through the historicity of the technology and its mechanical environment, Godard had written a project for a cinematographic essay, Moi Je, whose second part was entitled I Am a Machine, Moi Je Suis une Machine. However, unlike Frampton, Godard's aim was not to establish an aesthetics of the apparatus. Although the project took shape from a collage of pre-existing material, clear breaks and shattered associations, Moi Je is clearly intended to be taken as an essay, not a self-portrait in the pictorial sense of the term, much less an autobiography. Michael Temple accords this project the same status as Godard's later video essays, describing it as a work that, and I quote Michael, is materially hybrid, intended as provisional, philosophically speculative, and open to the future, end of quote. In his outline for a meta-history of cinema, Frampton simultaneously emphasizes the critical and meta-historical functions of the art of film by introducing an unusual distinction between historians and meta-historians. For Frampton, the first stands before a multitude, a treasure of films, not all of which are masterpieces, far from it, and that belong to domains of different as educational films, amateur films, or what Frampton calls endoscopic cinematography, in other words, utilitarian cinema. The historian answers for every exciting filmic images. The meta-historian, on the other hand, invents a tradition by selecting and defining a single artistic domain. Starting from the archive as a material basis, Frampton, by the way of a positivist exaggeration, Thus sees the film historian as confronted by the virtual corpus of all existing films, while associating the meta historian, who is ultimately a metaphor for an avant-garde filmmaker, with another form of virtual infinity. This infinity is no longer connected to the macro level of the corpus of all films, but the micro level of the body of an individual film. Frampton stresses the reiterability and the malleability of the film's material. I quote Frampton, "There's no evidence in the structural logic of the film strip that distinguishes footage from its finished work. Thus, any piece of film may be regarded as footage for use in any imaginable way to construct or reconstruct a new work," end of quote. If we understand the history of cinema as a living discourse disseminated in particular by filmmakers themselves, in the direction that Frampton indicated, the history of what in America is called independent or avant-garde cinema must be seen first of all in the context of a confrontation with the dominant strain of American cinema. And I'm sorry, I won't concentrate on third cinema in this part of my talk. In this respect, we may say that avant-gardistic practices are essayistic when they produce what Adorno calls an immanent critique of reflective formations. Scott MacDonald, the historian of avant-garde film, assigns this role to the work of Morgan Fisher, noting quite rightly, I quote MacDonald, "Nowhere is this critical function of independent avant-garde film more apparent than in the work of Morgan Fisher." The same year that Hollis Frampton died, go back to Hollis Frampton, Fisher, an artist and avant-garde filmmaker from the West Coast, made a film that could be seen as an homage to Frampton's nostalgia, but also as an implementation of Frampton's conception of a meta history of film. His experimental, one could say documentary, but due to Peter Wolin, I would say it's an avant-garde film. His film Standard Gauge from 84 is constructed with a rare level of radicalness out of the apparatuses and raw material of filmmaking. Fisher had grown familiar with that environment over several years by way of highly varied set of activities. In line with Frampton's work in nostalgia, small pieces of footage collected from the trash cans of the editing rooms of American studios offer an opportunity to make association of an autobiographical nature by the essential use of an off-voice. On the meta-historical level, it's again a matter of demonstrating the limits of a memorializing narrative founded on the signifying dimension of images and of establishing the fictional character of factographic constructions. On the historical level, the film presents fragments of a sub-history of Hollywood that concerns itself with the economic and social determinations of technique. And I will show you a short clip of the film now. In several respects, Morgan Fisher works in what Frampton would see as a meta-historical perspective. First, through the use of the light table and leftover footage from the editing room, Standard Gauge highlights the physical act of editing and in so doing illustrates its own production techniques. Second, by emphasizing the materiality of its visual component, the film references the conditions of its presentation, in other words, the celluloid that passes through the projector during the projection and never appears as such. He therefore shows the other film, to borrow Thierry Kunzel's expression, the one that is denied by the projection. Here, Fisher creates an infinite film in Frampton's sense by presenting the film stock as the juxtaposition of identical or nearly identical still frames. And third, the film is understood here as a piece that can be played, even arranged during the performance. Fisher emphasizes this active dimension to the extent that instead of copying the found footage, he slides the film strips, as you have seen, by hand onto the light table. He shows the images at rest, but he sets them in motion each time he brings the film strip into the frame or takes it out. And we can say that finally, Standard Gauge constitutes a reflection on the question of what images can bring about as far as memories, words, and possible associations are concerned. So the rigorous system of the stationary camera and the concentrated voice-over, The search for the exact words, the right tone that the images call for, takes shape. Occasionally, we see on screen the material inscription of the soundtrack on a piece of footage. So this indicates that sound, unlike the commented image, cannot be made readable or audible without a technical apparatus. The meta-historian of cinema, writes Frampton, is occupied with inventing a tradition that is a coherent, widely set of discrete monuments meant to inseminate resonant consistency into the growing body of his art, end of quote. In his brief but perceptive material history of 35mm film, Morgan Fisher seems to meditate on this unusual dimension of monuments. In a way, he makes them speak against their nature, like documents rescued by chance. He elevates them on an unexpected level of pictorial beauty by integrating them into a new order of visibility. Fisher connects with Frampton's viewpoint when he raises the question of that resonant consistency in the art of cinema by concentrating in his work on a tradition of found footage through his regular references to Bruce Conner's A Movie, but also through stock shots of the Hindenburg or by the indirect homage of Frampton's films Nostalgia with the frame-by-frame approach to the images and Poetic Justice with a serial principle. Jean-Luc Godard, who was apparently a latecomer to Frampton's work, also seemed to react to the romantic aspect of Frampton's definition of the task of the meta-historian of cinema when he decides to include this text in the presentation of Histoire du cinéma and consequently to establish the link with an avant-garde that remains completely absent of the corpus of his own film. But while Frampton, speaking of the resonant consistency of the art of cinema, is ultimately concerned with the intentional precincts of the American avant-garde, as it had constituted itself since Maya Deren, Godard references another resonant corpus entirely. Frampton, and in the very sense that Peter Boland distinguishes the two avant-gardes. Frampton, in a way that is not free of contradictions, incidentally extends the film historian's task to all films in the history of cinema and therefore to marginal genres as well, still mainly inured by historiography. On the other hand, he limits the meta-historian's task to the American school of the avant-garde cinema. As for Godard, he relies upon the cinephilic tradition of the French school of criticism from which he emerged on the film canonized by him and his peers. Histoire du cinéma is only concerned with the requirement and extensive as it is metaphorical to encompass all the history, toutes les histoires, the title of the first chapter, 1A, in order to bring them together in one history, une histoire seule, 1B, through a monumentalization not only of the history of cinema but also of cinema's history. And I just give a reference to Michael Witt's seminal book that was published last year about the Histoire du cinéma. Godard is a historian. Ultimately, Godard also carries on the utopian project of a history of cinema that would be conceived in relation to all the history of the cinema that were never made, as the title of part 1A of Histoire du cinéma puts it. His film on German reunification, German Year 90, which was produced while Godard was working on the Histoire, thus includes film shot after the defeat of the Third Reich, but not in Germany or not by Germans. It is a passport toto comprising, for example, The Passenger, the expiatory film of the Polish director Andrzej Munk, or Roberto Rossellini's Germany Year Zero from 48. The slowed down and anamorphically distorted excerpt from Munk's film, left incomplete at his death, marks it as a fragment and a presentation of that which is not filmed. The shots taken from Rossellini's films are also called upon examples, with their insistence on the motif of ruins. The excerpt from Rossellini demonstrates the function of cinema as trace or a symbol of history. This synecdochical or metaphorical construction of history of cinema conforms with an integrative and at the same time representative mode. And Godard's belief in the force of images as archives of their time can also be linked to the ambivalence of the figure of the historian that Michael Witt is relating to, such as his Histoire shed lights on it, especially through the myths of Orpheus, Orpheus who turns around toward Eurydice, but who doesn't have to die, who nevertheless, as Jacquemont underlines, is transformed into a salt statue in cinema. In one of his later videos, The Old Place, Godard explicitly associates his melancholic method to the thinking of Benjamin. In an off-screen conversation with Anne-Marie Mieville, we hear him say, "For Benjamin, the totality of all ideas forms a primordial landscape always present." And I will show you a short quote of The Old Place. I'm sorry, I didn't manage to copy the English subtitles. I don't know why. you saw the integration of several stock shots into this opening scene of Bergman's Lucille, the Silence. This is the English title. And another figure of Godard's idea about cinema, very Christian idea of cinema as an art of resurrection. If one wants to describe in Freudian Benjaminian terms the ambivalent function of memory in Godard's work, we could establish that forgetting makes it possible to protect our impressions, to ensure their conservation in the mind, while memory decomposes and destroys them. It's a very ambivalent function. For Godard, quoting other films is also and always carrying on out a posthumous operation, we could say, with Benjamin, on the monuments to be remembered of the rubble-strewn field of cinema history, and history as well. Germany, year 90 seems to radicalize this constellation. We could transpose Benjamin's conception to a visual framework by saying, faced with this rubble-strewn field, in the here and now of historical survival, it is a question of reading the past in an allegorical mode, while at the same time bringing out from within an utopian element. Here Godard develops a mnemonic principle along the lines of hieroglyphic writing, where culture replaces natural history and at the same time sets it down in the encoded writing of the past. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, in the cultural landscapes of the banks of the Havel, before the derelict buildings of Babelsberg, and in reconstructed neoclassical Berlin, Godard finds the material for his pessimistic reflection on history at the turn of the century. And although Godard plays with indirectly quoting a series of characters from his own films, Germany year 90 presents itself through its direct appropriations of images and sound, like a kind of extension of this histoire, like an essay on history. And these fragments hijacked from musicals, drawings, photos, paintings, but also from archived films, are associated with images and sound recorded by the filmmaker himself, reworked and variated. And it's very interesting that at the end, at the middle of Germany 90, in the third variation entitled All the Dragons of Our Lives, Godard symbolically brings to life a statue erected in front of the Altes Museum in Berlin, representing a Greek horseman fighting a lion. He sets the bronze sculpture in motion by framing it in a series of still shots of different focal lengths, at different distances and different angles, before finally filming the statue so that the background features a portion of the Berlin Cathedral that faces the museum. You see it here. In this way, a figure of a confrontation appears, the dynamic representation of an idea of openness in museum architecture. And at the same time, this animation, we could say, references the symbolic awakening of the lions in Eisenstein's Battleship Potemkin, a film for which Godard erects a monument in the first part of the histoire in form of a direct quotation. The filmmaker transposes into his film on Germany the motif of the statue by creating, like Eisenstein, bodily movement through the variation of the shots. He carries out a similar transposition on the soundtrack with variations on a musical theme from the second movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Godard commented on Eisenstein's method in his Frankfurt speech for the Adorno Award. Quote Godard, if the three lions create a montage effect, it's because the shots are from three different angles, not because there's montage. It's there for the variation on several levels, transposed repetition that, according to Godard, produces the figures of cinema. The sense of history emerges out of this very displacement, I would say. And I guess I have to skip now the part about Kluge, but maybe I show you, because I really wanted to compare these three filmmakers, Hollis Frampton, let's say Morgan Fisher and Hollis Frampton, Godard and Kluge. Kluge, who comes from literature and from the writing practice, and has been making films from the 60s on, and very, as you know, maybe, and television work. In the work of television, he continues his essayistic mode. He's referring to Musil when he describes his way of giving a personal way of form of a thought to his creations. Miriam Hansen was one of the I would say dialogue partners of Alexander Kluge, who did a series of TV magazines about cinema. And I just show you a short clip of one of Kluge's, here you see, of one of Kluge's TV magazines. Kluge does collage sometimes within the image, like here, King Kong, that he merges with drawing sketches, and not only literature or words coming by the voiceover, but also combining with inscriptions. And I show you, maybe you can just have an idea about Kluge's concept of a time place that he uses to define cinema, that he sees as a medium more linked to a public space and a temporal mode of perception than a spatial one, fluctuating in projection between immobility and movement, between light and darkness. And according to Miriam Hansen, in Kluge's work, this metaphor translated into an aesthetics of montage, of gaps and pauses in which the spectator's inner film swerves from the film as it creates in the spectator's mind. So I show you a short clip from one of Kluge's magazines, including a film of Edison. He has a specific taste for primitive diversity, as he says, for cinematographic forms of distraction like the circus. I can say this, I have to translate, man sieht sehr wenig, one does see very little. Commenting on this electrocuting an elephant. I try to conclude within the framework of the strategies of appropriation that we have compared here as examples. We see word and image interacting with each other in different configurations. Frampton and Fisher give each other of them a great deal of autonomy in order to be able to call on language and visual analytics respectively. Godard is more interested in the poetic force that is born of the interpenetration of the word and the image, which benefits the image most of all. Finally, Kluge's montages develop an authentically Benjaminian dialectics focused on a mode of thinking by way of images, but which nonetheless remains connected to language. As for the incorporation of pre-existing material, this difference can be seen in the relationship that each of these filmmakers maintains with the history of cinema. while Kluge, in the tradition of late Krakauer, is interested primarily in the narrative forms of microhistory in the web of macrohistory, for Godard it is a question of cinema's particular function relative to history on the grand scale. Finally, for Frampton and Fisher, the main accent is on the connection that binds the history of cinema to the historicity of its technical and economic apparatuses in terms of an aesthetics of material that is understood as the foundation of their cinematic art. We could resume this comparison between three positions of that filmmaker historians can take by saying that the conception of history and the structuring of meta-history are a matter of montage and collage. Each time the method of reuse are closely dependent on the very idea that these filmmakers have of cinema. Fisher remains true to the conceptual criteria of the American avant-garde, while at the same time extending them. His rearrangement of still frames aims to see the film in a new light, literally, and to create a particular kind of tension between on-screen and off-screen space in order to convey the idea of a specific environment for memory, a powerful instrument of the mind. And we could also see this in Fisher's installation art, and he's also a painter, as you might know. We are preparing a book about Fisher in France. Within his romantic aesthetics, Godard reserves a special place for cinema whose affective modes he attempts to isolate while referring to Eisenstein's concept on the dynamism of images. Kluge is probably closer to Chris Macaire than to Godard. He has made a portrait or an account of Godard called Blind Love. Insofar as the two filmmaker writers, Macaire and Kluge, consider the relationship between words and images, between writing and the editing of shots as essential, these associations forge a critical path towards the analysis of what Abi Warburg called Schlagbilder, the shock images of the visual history of culture. And I will stop here, just say that maybe in the discussion later we could also try to see whether this distinction between the two avant-gardes that has been so clear 20 years ago still, as I saw with my friend and the artist Peter Czerkaski, who curated at the time the found footage show, and it was Harun Farocki who advised us for our essay film show in 91 at the Stadtkino, and he who was of course presented in our program. At the time, there was no connection, and nowadays, these kind of art merge, and there are, of course, filmmakers and artists who wouldn't look after integration in one history or the other. I just present a Berlin-based Portuguese artist working on third cinema, Filipa César, Laura, I don't know whether she turned back. Oh yeah, here she is. And we have a specific love for Filipa César's Cacheo. And New York-based video artist. This notion doesn't exist anymore because nowadays you talk about media art or Shelley Silva, she has just now, these days, a retrospective at the Cinéma du Réel, which is a film festival. But she is an artist coming from video art. So I think the two avant-gardes Peter Wohlen was talking about in his influential essay and the history of video art that Ursula Biemann was also somehow treating in her book that Iger was relating to, they certainly merge today because technology also, not only because technology changed, but maybe the program and the history is rewritten and it's an ongoing process. Thank you.